A Deeper Dive is brought to you by Zero Hour Health, the industry leader in health crisis prevention and management. Zero Hour Health will help you create a culture of safety, preventing health crises before they make headlines. Their suite of services are tailored to protect your employees, customers, and your brand. Visit ZeroHourHealth.com to learn more.
Starbucks is the most complicated, simple business on the planet. Hello, this is Jonathan Mays, Editor-in-Chief of Restaurant Business. And in this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, I am joined by my RB colleague, Peter Romeo, and we talk about Starbucks. Peter and I toured the company's Seattle headquarters for an upcoming series on restaurantbusinessonline.com. We talk about how Starbucks has evolved over the years from a simple coffee shop chain into a global behemoth selling customizable beverages through numerous ordering channels. We also talk about how that has impacted the company's workforce and how it has fed into an unprecedented union drive. We then talk about new CEO Laxman Narasimhan and how his 6 months immersion into Starbucks culture is playing a role in all of this. We also talk about our apparently higher than expected tolerance for caffeine. So we're talking about Starbucks on A Deeper Dive, so please have a listen. Okay, I am here with Peter Romeo. Peter, welcome again.
Hey, Jonathan. Good to be back with you.
All right, super. So I hear we went to Starbucks headquarters recently. What was your thoughts on that, just generally speaking?
Well, first of all, the human body can absorb a lot more caffeine than I thought was ever possible, given how much coffee we drank out there. But it was very, very interesting. I don't think that the new team that's in place is overstating it when they say that they're trying to push the brand to the next level or the next step in its evolution, and that it has some profound change or involves some profound changes. You got that sense that things are new, things are different, that with Laxman coming in as CEO, that they are really trying to adjust the culture to the times. And we heard about that and saw that in droves. One thing that really struck me in the past when I've dealt with Starbucks, it had always presented itself as the third place, the place where you go and hang out and have a drink and work on your laptop. But this time around, we heard a lot about efforts to bolster that convenience. And that hadn't been part of the picture, really. So it seemed like that alone was a sea change. But certainly, the union situation has fed this feeling that the brand has to grow up a little. So I think it was pretty eye-opening to see what's afoot for the chain.
Yeah. So a few, I guess, numbers to sort of focus a little bit on sort of how different the company is and the immense level of change at the brand. So first, when we talk about convenience, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3/4 of the chain's sales, total sales, now comes through either mobile order and delivery, or mobile order and pay, drive-through, or delivery now. And delivery is a rapidly growing source of sales. To the point now, by the way, where they are testing ghost kitchens, or they're working on ghost kitchens, and they expect within a couple of years that 40% of their delivery sales will be serviced by some of these ghost kitchens, which is fascinating, given the fact that much of the industry is sort of going away a little bit from delivery-only kitchens. Starbucks seems to be going rapidly in that particular direction. And you know, and we could talk a little bit about that a little bit later, but it sort of is, to me, the fact that they're shifting all of these delivery sales away from, trying to shift their delivery sales away from their existing locations to the specialty locations and planning to do that. If you're going to do 40%, you're doing a fairly broad set of delivery only kitchens, is indicative to me of kind of the pressure their stores are under from the number of different service channels that they, in service modes that they're dealing with right now, which kind of you know, a lot of this stuff feeds into that whole element of, you know, the difficulty it is, the difficulty that the staff has working at one of these coffee shops. You know, it's no longer just about servicing coffee shop customers or, you know, people who sit there and stay at a and drink their beverage on site or take it on their way to work. I mean, it is a much broader group of customers who are mostly taking their drinks with them. And then the types of drinks that they're ordering are really, really complicated. And I mean, I think the phrase that I like to think about with Starbucks is that it is the most complicated, simple business on the planet. That on balance, it is a beverage concept that is a coffee chain. But what you get from there is just much more different. So another number is three quarters or more, depending on the season, of their beverages are cold. And most of them are customized. So you customize them with various flavor shots or cold foams or whatever weird foam that they happen to be coming out with at any given moment. And, you know, so you add all of this up. So you have, you know, at a single coffee shop, you're going to have baristas that are doing a ton to keep up with customers, because the typical Starbucks is actually very busy. And then they're getting orders from the drive-through. They're getting orders coming inside. They're getting orders from mobile order. They're getting orders from delivery and things like that. So it just makes a much more complicated business than it ever was.
Oh, no doubt about it. And I mean, we heard that when we went into some of the stores. The thing that stuck in my mind was they were saying that when a customer would come up with a new mix, a new blend, a new combination of elements, it might have 9 or 10 elements in it. And they'll post it on Instagram. And because of that, they'll get hit with 100 orders in no time, in minutes. And they've got to deliver on that. So there's not a doubt in my mind that they are wrestling, and actually they acknowledge this, they are wrestling with that trade-off between the romance that Howard Schultz, the godfather of the brand, for all extensive purposes, the founder and three times CEO, and the new management, they're wrestling with that artistry, that romance, then they've got convenience. How do you do that? And so some of the things that we saw in their lab that they are rolling out, like the Clover Vertica machine, which goes 100% contrary to what Schultz had said about delivering the romance, watching the baristas mix. That is an automated thing where basically the barista presses one button. Things like that, or the automatic ice dispenser. I think you and I were both amazed to hear that they could lug up to 75 buckets of ice per day to their ice bin, and that's to slow things down. So trying to find those ways when they can deliver on that convenience piece without sacrificing that magic, that showmanship, that artistry. But definitely they're moving away from that. They have to, by virtue of what the customers want, for sure.
Yeah. That's actually an interesting point when you think about it, is and this is general. We're seeing this issue play itself out all over the restaurant business, where in the last few years, in particular, labor availability has just become a challenge in the restaurant space. And that's an issue, like, let's face it, the issue that Starbucks was dealing with in 2020 and 2021 when its unionization situation came up was the same issue that much of the restaurant business has been dealing with. And Starbucks is just generally a different company. I tend to believe that Starbucks employees are a little bit more activist than your typical restaurant employee. And it fueled an environment that sort of led to this unionization drive. And you know, and by the way, these jobs are very difficult. Working in a restaurant is difficult. I don't really care what restaurant you work in. I mean, I spent my, I did my duty at McDonald's, and that is still the hardest I'd worked. And I actually had a wide variety of jobs growing up. But working in a McDonald's was, you get burned, you get, you're on your feet all day. You know, you have to deal with customers that are pissed off at you for whatever reason. But the issue that was dealing with is that the industry is dealing with now that the cost and availability of labor is just not what it used to be. And in the fast food industry in particular, is that it is forcing companies to start rethinking how they do things in the back of the house. And Starbucks is not remotely the only company that is dealing with the question of how do we promote this idea that we are a restaurant doing quality work with this idea that with this need to be efficient and fast and do so and make life easier for employees. And I say this, like, for instance, you know, Domino's Pizza is a perfect example of this. Domino's Pizza just is coming out with, inside their pizza shops, dough stretchers. And they're actually relatively common. You know, Papa John's uses something similar where it helps stretch the dough and slows down the process for you know, turning a ball of dough into a pizza crust. You know, but they had long said, we're not going to do that sort of thing. We're not going to do that sort of automation because they prided themselves on that element. But the fact is that in recent years, labor is so hard to come by, and the job that it's just putting so much attention on the difficulty of doing the job that there is a need in the industry to sort of shift in this direction. And Starbucks is dealing with that question as much, if not more, than anybody else because of the way that Schultz created the brand and what the brand has stood for a long time, which is this idea of a third place, a place where you go and enjoy a good cup of coffee. And now they have to do things like the Clover Vertica, which is basically a glorified Keurig machine for drip coffee. By the way, interesting that drip coffee became the difficult thing at Starbucks that they have to automate because you know, theoretically, it's the easiest thing to do. But the fact that they had to go and make the coffee became too complicated because they're too busy doing these, you know, cold foam with three shots of mocha, salted caramel, whatever.
That came out when I talked to the employees up in Buffalo when the union drive first began, and asking them what they didn't like about the job. First of all, they all attested, everyone I spoke to, and I spoke with two or three, and they were sort of the leaders of that movement. They said that they loved working for Starbucks, but they said the job was getting much, much harder. Part of it was that switch over to cold drinks, or I guess more particularly frothy drinks, where they were either frothing milk for the cold cream topping or just mixing the beverage itself, that it was becoming so much harder. And yet you still at the same time had that push for convenience on the consumer's part. So the employees felt caught between those two dynamics themselves. You know, you mentioned numbers. One of the numbers that I think stunned both of us was when they mentioned that their turnover had soared, and that was the word that they used, to 85% from their usual 50 to 65%. And that said a lot. I mean, I think any other quick service operation out there would love to have a turnover of 85%, but they looked at that as such an indictment. So they realize they've got to make the job easier for their baristas. And it seems like they're doing that in really, really granular ways. I mean, one of the things we heard was that the baristas used to have to tap the little strainer looking thing to knock out the plug of brewed coffee. And they would do it so often in the course of a shift that people started developing carpal tunnel syndrome. Yeah. And they've gotten away from that. So they've really rethought the process. But again, against that backdrop of what they've historically been as a caffeine mixology center, as well as source of just a buzz in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. I was for the package that we're working on, I went and looked at some of these creations that people make. And you know, for instance, here's like a venti cold brew with toffee nut syrup, milk, vanilla sweet cream, cold foam, and caramel drizzle. You know, and this was shared on Pinterest. Here's another one. venti iced latte with coconut milk, 3 pumps of sugar-free vanilla, 3 pumps of sugar-free cinnamon dolce, 3 scoops of vanilla bean powder, and sweet foam. And then another one, a cold brew with salted cream cold foam, 2 pumps of caramel syrup, 3 pumps of toffee nut syrup, and almond milk. So the issue is that Starbucks has become not just a beverage retailer, but a really complicated, customized beverage retailer. And it just made, Starbucks kind of, let's face it, Starbucks actually did it to themselves. They're the ones that have been operating it. And by the way, those flavor shots that people are doing, these 3 pumps of toffee nut syrup, for instance, that's like 80 cents a piece.
Yeah.
They do that.
Yeah.
And that's basically this. Yeah. Theoretically, it's a very simple, highly, highly profitable thing for Starbucks to do. And they sell $1 billion worth of this in the United States every single year. Those beverage modifiers.
Yeah, that's what's astounding. I mean, the scale of what they do is just staggering. The shots, the flavor shots are $1 billion. The cold foam is now $1 billion. That's astronomical. Mm-hmm. Even the tidbit we were talking about before, about how they had to replenish their ice bin 75 times a day. Yep. That really speaks to how many people they are cranking through. That's the other complication, just being able to do it on scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what did you think of their new CEO?
Oh, he's a nice guy.
Well, he was very interesting.
He was very interesting, yeah, for sure.
One of the things we kept hearing was that he showed up all the time in the background of Zoom meetings, mm-hmm. in the headquarters there, because he loves to walk around and talk to people. And although we got that sense about some of his predecessors, he seems to have taken it to a new level.
Yeah.
And we saw his office and saw how he's tried to make it as much like a unit as he can, with the table being his desk being made out of the material that they use the table for in Starbucks, the lamps, all that kind of stuff. So he really seems like he's a in the field kind of guy, as much as a CEO of a multi-billion dollar multinational company can be.
Yeah. I mean, the office... The desk was the communal table that you find at in a Starbucks cafe. The chairs all came from Starbucks. He's got a lot of Starbucks stuff on his shelves. He's got a bunch of it, actually. And he was pretty proud of the fact that everything in his office came from a Starbucks. But the interesting thing, and so the deal is, he spent 6 months working inside Starbucks locations, and he got barista training. He traveled all over the world visiting Starbucks locations. He had said this on a podcast. He will work in Starbucks whenever he gets the chance, and even did it when he was visiting his ill mother working at the Starbucks in the hospital. And the issue is, what he said is that this was a very unique situation. I can't recall, maybe you can, a situation where a brand new CEO came in from the outside and got, on the ground training for that long.
Exactly.
And several months in which he was immersed into Starbucks culture. The interesting thing to me about that is, if you think about his background, he was a McKinsey guy. And he's stupid intelligent. I mean, this guy he's got more intelligence in his little finger than I have in mine and your body, probably. He's got, a pair of master's degrees, he knows a bunch of languages. He's lived all over the world. He was by all accounts highly, highly successful at McKinsey and spent 2 decades there. And then went to work for PepsiCo and then to Reckitt, in London. And, to me, the issue of him doing that barista training and getting that immersive experience was a very intelligent move on the company's part, because, essentially, almost sort of whitewashes a little bit the fact that he's a McKinsey guy. And I, you know as well as I do that McKinsey folks who become CEOs don't have reputations for being, you know, on the ground type people.
Exactly. They're
suits. They're trained. You know, I mean, McKinsey is a CEO factory, basically. Mm-hmm. And its reputation, frankly, is not the greatest. And, you know, if you're a company that is dealing with some immense situations within your workforce. And again, going back to that unionization campaign, which to me is a symbolic of what's going on. And, you know, there needs to be that element here where the CEO is seen with employees, has a good relationship with the regular staff, and is not seen as this heartless numbers cruncher who is only looking to satisfy Wall Street demands for cost cuts. And, you know, it was definitely a need thing for him to have that. And to me, it does seem genuine. I mean, when we were interviewing him, he was very much emotional when we started talking about some of these things, in particular when we talked about the difficulty of workers and the challenges that the brand in particular had coming out of the pandemic. He got really animated, and it's difficult to really come across, but got very, very animated and almost emotional when he was talking about that. So,
yeah, I kept thinking in the back of my mind, why would they let us into the headquarters and give us access to executive after executive after executive? What was in it for them? They know we're not going to go with a coddling story. They know it's going to be a objective down the middle. And it was obvious after we talked with Laxman that he feels to understand what Starbucks is going through and what it went through with the union aspect, you had to keep in mind, or you had to be familiar with how much the pandemic affected restaurants. Now, you and I have written probably millions of words by this point about the effect of the pandemic, but he really believes that the common person out there, the common customer or shareholder, doesn't grasp that. And so he felt that that was an important backdrop. Yet he didn't shy away from taking responsibility on behalf of the management team that preceded him and acknowledging mistakes that they had made, acknowledging how hard the job was. You know, here you have this brilliant guy, and he readily acknowledges that he had trouble making some of those drinks and had to turn to the employees. I remember one executive remark that the frontier for Starbucks, at least operationally, is what's known internally as ledges and edges, what happens behind the counter, and that by virtue of having worked there as much as he does and still is working there, because he requires the C-suite to work in a unit at least 4 hours a month, that is going to change things. That is going to keep the focus on that employee. So, yeah, it was really interesting. It really underscored that Starbucks still is a pioneer, still is a leader in terms of adjusting to the times in terms of labor, but clearly that mandate is to simplify the job for employees and that way counter the union drive rather than out and out resistance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually fascinating. I mean, you did a piece not that long last year on the number of former consultants that are now leading mm-hmm. restaurant companies. And so it's pretty substantial number. And, you know, to me, I think it's a great lesson. You know, there is a lot of, you know, the industry right now, there's a bit of a tension between, you know, the executive level and, you know, sort of the ground floor folks. And we see it actually, it's really pronounced at McDonald's, where, you know, McDonald's franchisees at a meeting last year or the year before handed out at a meeting, at a franchisee meeting, handed out books, the book When McKinsey Comes to Town. And, you know, concern, you know, by the way, Chris Kempczinski never worked for McKinsey, but there's, you know, McKinsey has played a role in a lot of McDonald's plans in the last few years. And that has, you know, and that was, you know, but that, you know, there's a lot of tension between, you know, the operator class and the executive class. And, you know, and sometimes, and when the executive class is seen as out of touch, it can really create a great deal of tension.
Yeah,
that's an interesting issue. And to me, I think that what Laxman did is actually really intelligent, going in and working almost constantly in stores. If I was a CEO of a restaurant company, and I never will be, but if I was a CEO of a restaurant company, I would absolutely be in my stores all the damn time.
Right.
And you cannot be in your stores nearly enough. And I will also mention one quote. What was the, what's the, remember the show Undercover Boss? I don't know if it's still, but you would get, the restaurant industry is, was a frequent guest. You know, restaurant CEOs were frequent guests of that program. And I'll never forget mentioning this, talking with Craig Culver about this. About that show, and he said, "If your staff doesn't know what you look like, you're doing it wrong."
Well, you know, it used to be. I mean, we've been at this long enough where we know that you typically, when a CEO gets a new job, when a new CEO comes in, they go and they work a shift or a few hours. I remember the CEO of a major casual dining chain telling me he chopped carrots for 4 hours, and that was enough for him. But part of the reason why they do it later on is to teach the employees. Now it seems the employees are teaching the executives. And the other thing that's happened as a result of the pandemic is the customer used to be the paramount constituent. You serve that person more than any other, more than your employees, more than your shareholders, even in some extent, because they that was the basis. Now it seems as if the employee is just every bit as important as that customer. And we got a sense of that at Starbucks. We heard as much about employees and cultivating that and fostering a tighter relationship there than we did about appealing to customers. So definitely times have changed for sure. And there's been a more professionalization of the CEO, which is a good thing, but the job's become so much more complicated that it makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I think Starbucks was a prime example. The scale of that place, or even the size of the headquarters, was really pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was very much so. Peter, this was fantastic. Really appreciate you joining me on the podcast once again. And remember to look out for our series on Starbucks coming up in a few days. Thanks very much, Peter.
Thank you, Jonathan. Take care.
And that should do it for this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, which was edited, as always, by Spoons. Artwork by Nico Hines. You may find this and other episodes of the podcast on our website at www.restaurantbusinessonline.com/article/deeper-dive. And you may subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I am Jonathan Mays, your host, podcast producer, and the editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Deeper Dive, brought to you this week by Zero Hour Health, the number one health advisory firm in the food service and hospitality industries. If you want to learn more about how Zero Hour Health can protect your business, check out zerohourhealth.com.